Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. The Queen of the Skies, also known as the Boeing 747, makes its final flight for United Airlines.
Even though it was a large airplane, it handled like a little sports car, super easy to land, and a technological marvel of the time.
Hear from 747 pilots and get a glimpse of how you might fly in the future. With better air and lighting, maybe more comfortable seating, and the return of supersonic planes. And if you're road tripping to the desert, we have some art and architecture recommendations for you. But let's start today's show by going underground.
Careful, be careful. One at a time.
To check out a tunnel that is currently under construction 60 feet below Little Tokyo. It's an S-shaped tunnel and it's finished in curving concrete panels. It's called the Downtown Regional Connector and this will link the Expo Blue and Gold Lines. We got a chance to check it out last week when Mayor Eric Garcetti toured it with New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu.
So the Regional Connector is a fancy way of saying we are building a subway under downtown that will allow you, if you're coming from Santa Monica and going to the east side or going Long Beach to Pasadena, to never have to transfer again, but to stay in your seat and seamlessly go from north to south through downtown, east to west through downtown.
And expected completion date?
Expected completion date now, what were we at?
December 2021.
So hopefully, good, I'm still going to be in office then. So by December 2021, we'll have this done. We ran into some initial complications as you drill down in a place as complicated as downtown Los Angeles, the amount of pipes and wires and past work that had been done slowed us down a little at the beginning, but now we're on track.
And the tunnel itself is kind of a pretty tunnel. Tell us about it.
It's a sexy tunnel. You know, you look at those, the architecture. A lot of people don't appreciate each piece of concrete and that this has to be able to twist like a snake's body. It's almost like the scales on a snake, but we see the inside of it. Each one of these beautiful concrete pieces made here locally, manufactured in LA County, is put together like a jigsaw puzzle. And you're going to be speeding by, so you probably can't appreciate it, but in a walk like today, Mayor Landrieu and I could actually see just what marvelous American craftsmanship that is.
That's Mayor Eric Garcetti. The Regional Connector is one of several tunnel projects underway in LA right now. But the one you may have heard most about is the one being dug by LA's favorite mad genius, Elon Musk. Yes, Musk has complained loudly about his own LA commute, and he has suggested various concepts for speeding it up. He once told DNA he wanted to put another deck over the 405. Well, now he's aiming for a tunnel network in which vehicles would be lowered down onto rails on an electric skate. These skates would shoot underground at around 130 miles per hour. He described it in a TED Talks event earlier this year.
There's no real limit to how many levels of tunnel you can have. See, you can go much further deep than you can go up. The deepest mines are much deeper than the tallest buildings are tall. So you can alleviate any arbitrary level of urban congestion with a 3D tunnel network. You can go to any number of levels.
Well, Musk and his boring company are already at work on one of those tunnels. It starts under the parking lot of his company SpaceX in the city of Hawthorne. He just tweeted out an image of a stretch of tunnel that he says is 500 feet and should be 2 miles long in 3 or 4 months. He added that it will hopefully stretch the whole 405 north-south corridor from LAX to the 101 in a year or so. This means that if built, and it's a big if since this project would involve multiple cities and jurisdictions, the line would run conveniently near his own home in Bel Air. Back to Mayor Garcetti.
I was just talking to Elon yesterday. We're working very closely with a boring company, looking at the ways that we can accelerate projects like this. But the technology is changing every single day, whether it's interconnected cars, whether it's vertical takeoff and landing drones, whether it's the way that we tunnel. Elon's a particularly interesting case because he's changing the way we go vertically into space, the way that we're going to travel on the ground with something like Hyperloop and Tesla, and then maybe the way that we'll dig underground. So he's in three dimensions of changing it. If this technology works, you know, he wants to put, I think, cars in them. We'd probably be looking at trains or other vehicles. But if you can get a tunnel done 10 times more quickly, the biggest challenge is these construction guys will tell you it's not going to be even tunneling. How are you going to haul dirt out of the city 10 times more quickly? We might have to shut down every street. But these are good problems to tackle. And he's not the only guy working on this. Elon's good at getting the press to focus on it. But we've got an entire construction industry that is doing exceptional work. You see it right here.
That's Mayor Garcetti. You're listening to DNA, and I'm Frances Anderton. Now, obviously, the big challenge that faces tunnel diggers in LA is all the stuff that's already built above and below ground. Gary Baker is Metro's project manager for the regional connector.
On our very first tunnel, we ran into some abandoned steel. We believe they were steel piles that were left in the ground from earlier construction in the middle of the street. It was a high risk for our machine, but we were able to remove that pile and continue construction.
What happens to all the earth that you extract? Where does that wind up?
Yeah, one thing that people don't recognize is the amount of material that's mined. For every foot of advancement, we generate 14 tons of dirt. And so if we are running at 150 feet a day, you can imagine how many truckloads of material that is. That's 300 trucks it takes every day to remove the material.
Could it be recycled? Say another department in the city was building a park and they wanted to have a slope in their park. Could they come to you and say, can we have some of that earth?
That's possible. It depends on the type of material we're mining and the opportunities that exist. And so, yes, we do try to find a beneficial use, but it's not always available.
It feels like there's a lot of big infrastructure projects going on right now, and quite a few of them are tunnels. Are we in a kind of tunneling moment right now?
Well, for the tunneling contractors, it is a very exciting time, obviously. Yes, Metro right now has three active tunneling projects, a fourth one is soon to start. We have the Crenshaw Line, which is a combination of above ground and below ground work. We have the regional connector. And we have two segments of the Purple Line, which is the line running from downtown west towards Santa Monica. And that's an extension of an existing heavy rail system. So yes, there is a lot of tunneling going on in LA. If you're a tunneling contractor, it's a great opportunity to participate in what's really a building boom in Los Angeles, not just underground, but above ground, as you will notice.
That was Gary Baker. He's project manager for the Regional Connector. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now from boring to Boeing. You heard Mayor Garcetti say that technology is changing every single day. Well, today is the swan song for a soaring example of yesterday's technology. A United-owned Boeing 747 took off around noon today from San Francisco International Airport en route to Honolulu. It's a recreation of United's very first 747 flight, and today was its last. In a moment, we'll hear about what's coming next. And yes, designers are trying to make your journey more pleasant. But first, let's hear what made that 747 so special. Last month at LAX, we toured the famous plane and we met with some of its pilots. First up, Brent DeMoss.
I loved the 747. It was a great airplane. I loved flying it, even though it was a large airplane. It handled like a little sports car, super easy to land. And a technological marvel of the time.
We also met United pilots Kathleen Hesse and retired pilot Perry Cockraham. They're married to each other and they sometimes fly together. So, of course, we had to ask first if they ever bicker over the controls.
I know, that's what everybody asks, because we bicker about everything else. But no, we got along really well and enjoyed the time we spent flying together.
It seems like there's strong feeling for this airplane, the 747. Is there and why?
Yes, very definitely. There's very strong feeling. You know, the airplane itself is of an era. You know, it's one of the first wide bodies and was so much bigger. It was majestic. It's a beautiful airplane. It flies beautifully.
It's probably the sweetest airplane I've ever flown, and we've both flown quite a few different airplanes.
What makes it sweet?
Just the basic aerodynamic design, the way they design the flight controls. You can put it down quite easily, so gently that people wonder if you're really on the ground.
Perry, tell us about that moment when you first set eyes on the 747.
I was on my way to Vietnam the first time, and we had stopped to refuel on a DC-8 in the Philippines. And standing on a ramp looking across to the terminal, we saw this giant airplane, which I personally had never seen before, and it was a 747 for Pan Am. And it was just so majestic, so huge, so far beyond anything at the time, that it was just a very momentous day in my life to see it for the first time, and never really thinking I'd ever have the opportunity to fly one, 25 years later.
That was Kathleen Hesse and Perry Cockraham. They did acknowledge that newer planes like the 787 Dreamliner or the Airbus A350 are more comfortable for passengers because they have more humidity and lower cabin pressure, meaning less fatigue. Alberto Diaz is the chief pilot for United Airlines at LAX. He's been a passenger on the 747, but never the pilot, and he's less sentimental about its departure.
I'm not as nostalgic as some of the people are. I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to the future and the new airplanes coming online and stuff. So for the time, it was very, very revolutionary. But now, you know, nowadays, the airplane is kind of like a Mack truck, you know, kind of like a big SUV. And, you know, we're kind of going toward the Teslas, toward the sedans that are more fuel efficient and that kind of stuff. It's just an evolution, you know.
So when you refer to it as being like an SUV, you mean this is a heavy plane?
It's very, very heavy. I mean, I think the max takeoff is right around 1 million pounds. So it's very, very, very heavy. I mean, it carries over 300,000 pounds of fuel in the airplane.
So okay. This plane itself will be sold to another company?
Typically, I think these airplanes will just end up in the desert over at, you know, in Tucson at Davis-Monthan, or they'll end up in Mojave at the Mojave Desert, where they, you know, they take everything. They almost like vacuum seal them up, not vacuum seal them up, but prepare them for a long time in the desert.
You refer to the Tesla. Right. Does that mean that planes may ever go full electrification?
The airplanes are already starting to get very electrified, obviously. You know, the 787 has huge batteries underneath it that require a lot of cooling. And the flight controls, of course, are all fly-by-wire, fly-by-computer. And even the air conditioning systems, which normally would be supplied by the engines through the bleed air system, are now being supplied by electric air conditioning systems. So it is going that way.
Could you just tell us what you love about being a commercial airplane pilot?
Well, you know, flying is magical. You know, I think anytime... For us, even if we've been flying for 30 years and if we've flown in the military, it's still you're still defying gravity. You're still doing something that is something that a human being can't do. So it's magical in that sense of it. And every flight is a little bit different, believe it or not. And so it has its nuances and challenges, and it's rewarding in the sense of just accomplishing a challenging approach and landing in bad weather and all the things that go into it.
That was United Airline pilots Alberto Diaz, Kathleen Hesse, Perry Cockraham and Brent DeMoss, paying their respects to the 747. Boeing engineer Joe Sutter led the design team that created the 747. He died last year at the age of 95. Now the next generation of designers is busy rethinking flight. One of them is named Akash Chudasama. He's a transportation and user experience designer in Los Angeles focusing on flight. He says one of the reasons 747s are being replaced is because airlines are now focusing on moving more people in smaller planes to small, faraway destinations. And that means plane design has to change.
I think Qantas is about to start a new route from Perth to London, which is a 17-hour flight. And so that begs the question, so what are people supposed to do in these cabins? So, I mean, right now they're kind of like buses, but a lot of airlines, a lot of manufacturers are trying to bring in new concepts of interiors. I mean, can we change mood lighting, and can we add LED lighting and mimic what the skyscape looks like? Can we add high definition entertainment module to kind of bring a new sense of entertainment? Can we put Netflix and stuff in these airplanes? But also thinking about, how do we change seats? Can we stagger seats? Can we put bars in these airplanes? Can we essentially make airplanes cruise ships for the sky, since we'll be on there for so long?
So do you think that's what United's looking at? And do you think the Dreamliner and the Airbus are making moves in that direction? I mean, you're still trapped in your tight little seat if you're in coach, which is most people.
But I think the interesting people to follow are the smaller airlines, something like Virgin or JetBlue or some of the meaner European airlines. Also, the Middle Eastern airlines or, you know, Etihad or Qatar and Emirates, they have a lot of capital to try something different. And a lot of these airlines are starting to invest in really radical stuff.
Like what?
Well, there's a lot of controversy over this and there's a lot of criticism, but I think there's a lot of excitement about bringing supersonic air travel back into the skies. So we all know the Concorde flew from the 60s to the early 2000s. And you were able to fly Mach 2 in this really cool-looking airplane. It flies really fast. It's a very exclusive experience. I mean, it got you from London to New York and vice versa in about 3 hours, half the time a regular airliner could take you. Now, the problem with the Concorde, of course, was it was insanely expensive. But technology has changed a lot. And so there's new composites. We have better engines. We have better CFD technology, design aircraft. And so there's been an emergence of a lot of startups that are trying to bring supersonic planes back into the sky. There's a really neat company in Colorado called Boom Aero, and they are so determined to make the new Concorde. And so they got a lot of funding, and Richard Branson is actually a partner who apparently has ordered 10 supersonic jetliners from Boom Aero, as well as other companies.
Wow. And is it called Boom because it breaks through the sound barrier?
I think that's the idea.
Wow. But what about, and this is a different kind of problem, but related, which is fuel efficiency. And isn't that something that even folks like Richard Branson are trying to address?
Oh, yes. So the Concorde was a massive gas guzzler. But Boom claims they have some really efficient engine designs. And they made their airplane a lot lighter with really modern composites and carbon fiber materials. And they claim they have now developed the right aerodynamics to actually reduce the sonic boom, probably 30 times quieter than the Concorde was. And they claim that they've made their airplane actually about 30% more efficient in cost.
Well, Akash, it's really super interesting. I guess we should wrap by just mentioning Mr. Musk. You know, you can't have a conversation about transportation without Elon Musk's name coming into it. But he's involved with trying to speed up international flight. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. He definitely has the ideas. And so, of course, Mr. Musk wants to develop this really large spaceship, essentially, to ferry people from Earth to Mars. But part of their business strategy is, hey, we can actually probably use this spaceship to ferry people from one point on Earth to the other. And what we do is we take the spaceship and we would load it up with a bunch of people. We would fire the rocket engines. We'd actually send the ship into low Earth orbit, or at least on some really high ballistic trajectory. And we'd actually fly to another point on Earth via space, via low altitude space. And I think he claims we can get to New York, to Hong Kong in like 30 minutes, right? And hopefully that business model might eventually start funding the eventual trip to Mars.
But Akash, what would you put your money on?
I think we are going to not see the spaceship thing happen for a little while. But I think the supersonic might make a little bit of a comeback, and I'll tell you why. I think if we can make it affordable and somewhat environmentally friendly, then people, you know, there's one thing we don't get back in our lives, and money comes and goes, but we don't get a lot of time back in our lives. And I like to always say time is the new premium.
That was transportation designer Akash Chudasama. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up, the weather's cooling off, so it's a perfect time to go into the desert and visit three Pacific Standard Time LA shows.
Yeah. Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. We've been talking on this program a lot about Pacific Standard Time, LA, LA. There are still shows to go visit, still shows to talk about, and some of those are out there in the desert because we're heading into cooler temperatures. We felt this was a very good moment to visit some of those shows. I'm delighted to be joined by Marisa Kurtzman. She is an architect and she has just returned from a trip to go and see three shows that are out there in Palm Springs and Riverside. Welcome, Marisa.
Thank you, Frances. Nice to meet you.
So tell us about your trip and tell us about the shows that you saw.
Well, our first stop was at the Palm Springs Art Museum Architecture and Design Center to see an exhibition about Albert Frey and Lina Bobardi.
Just tell us who those two are.
Albert Frey was a Swiss architect. He actually worked with Le Corbusier in the early part of the 20th century. And then he immigrated to the States shortly before World War II and ended up settling in Palm Springs, where he became synonymous with Palm Springs modernism.
Sort of the darling of Palm Springs. I met Frey just before he died, and he was at something like age 93, still doing yoga. And I actually had a conversation with him on his head.
Oh, my goodness.
In his darling little 400-square-foot house. But anyway, he sadly passed, and he has been partnered with another architect of note. You just mentioned the name, Lina Bobardi.
Yes. Lina Bobardi was an Italian architect. She immigrated to Brazil right after World War II, I believe in 1946, where she continued to work and practice for the rest of her life, mostly in and around Sao Paulo. Apparently, Lina Bobardi was a big fan of Frey's, and we believe that Frey was also aware of Bobardi's work somewhat distantly. It's not clear whether they ever met, but they definitely had a lot in common.
Being?
Well, I asked Elizabeth Armstrong, the director of the Palm Springs Art Museum, about this, and she had a pretty good answer.
They both come out of European modernism, kind of a high European modernism. They come to the Americas. One goes north, one goes south. And they adapt to completely different landscapes, but landscapes that are dominant in a way that they wouldn't be in Europe, whether it's the desert in Palm Springs or the jungle in Brazil.
Frey really used his architecture to frame that landscape. There's a certain sense of awe about the landscape when you are in a Frey environment, but also a sense of really deep tranquility. In contrast, Bobardi, you know, the nature in Brazil, it's lush and it's close. And by the end, somewhat taking over her, you know, steel and glass, architecture becomes more replaced with things like rock walls and thatched roofs. It's an interesting evolution.
So, while at Palm Springs Museum, you also saw another show that you found, I think, quite interesting.
Yes, it's this show is called Kinesthesia, and it's a survey of Latin American kinetic art from the 1950s and 60s.
Sounds like moving. Does it move?
It does move. At a basic level, kinetic art is art that moves. But there are actually two kinds of kinetic art. One is art that moves on its own, so whether it's motorized or the wind makes the movement. The other kind of kinetic art is actually not really moving, but you are moving. So the spectator is moving around the art itself, and it's your movement that creates this illusion that the art is moving itself. One of my favorite rooms, which had a number of pieces by one artist, his name is Julio Leparque, and it was a dark room with a number of light-based art installations. And the effects were really spectacular. I mean, you had no idea what was going on, but it almost looked like the Northern Lights. But there were these little mechanisms in front of all the pieces. And, you know, when you stopped to actually look at what was happening, basically through really simple tricks with lights and mirrors, he was creating some really spectacular effects.
So interesting, especially as the hot show in LA right now is the Kusama show, which also plays
that's
with
true.
Mirror and light
yes.
in a way that's very, I guess, kinetic. But as I understand it, Latin America really produced some great kinetic art. Is there a connection between kinetic art and Latin America, or was everybody doing it?
According to art history, the center of kinetic art was actually in Paris. But a lot of Latin American artists were involved in the movement and actually went back and forth between Paris and their homes in Central and South America.
How very interesting. Now let's move on your trip. As you move back to LA, you go via Riverside. What's in Riverside?
At the Riverside Art Museum, there's a really interesting show about Spanish colonial revival architecture in the Inland Empire.
It is called Myth and Mirage.
What this show is really about is the history of an architectural style that was invented at the turn of the 20th century to create an image of Southern California as an exotic paradise with roots in Spanish colonialism.
And to sell Southern California kind of as a product.
Yes. In fact, the Spanish colonial style, which we all know of very well, stucco walls, red tile roofs, wrought iron work, very ornate plaster work. It's a fantasy. That was what was so fascinating about it. It turns out that while the architects who propagated the style drew a lot of inspiration from the missions were pretty dilapidated at the time. And so there was a lot of room for imagination. Downtown Riverside is a center of Spanish colonial revival architecture. If you just walk 3 blocks in downtown Riverside, you'll see quite an array of really spectacular buildings. The most famous one is the Mission Inn, which is I would say it's almost a wedding cake of a hotel. It's really elaborately done. It is spectacular and it's extremely popular.
What you're saying is make sure you also go and look at some of the actual buildings.
Definitely. What I also found particularly interesting about this exhibition is the fact that it calls attention to the notion of this fantasy and actually highlights some of the darker side of the Spanish colonial revival movement. Underneath the fantasy was a population of indigenous and Mexican American people who were used to build these buildings, but given absolutely no credit for it.
And is that explored in the exhibition?
Yes. Lindsay Rossi, the curator of the exhibition, put it very well.
This is a very regional show, so we wanted to make sure that we highlighted a lot of the architecture that people were familiar with around here that maybe they took for granted. We want people to notice the contemporary versions of it in our everyday environment in places like Home Depot or movie theaters and things, but we also want them to understand the actual historic buildings that it all came from. And also, we want to explore some of the issues pertaining to class and race that has largely been overlooked when discussing architecture in general.
As an architect, I took a lot away from this show. Personally, for me, it reminded me that as an architect, what I do doesn't just exist free-floating as a form out in the environment. These things are somewhat inherently political, and they have political implications for the people who build them, for the people who see them. They have layers of meaning that I think are really fascinating and are something that we should really pay attention to.
Marisa Kurtzman was talking about 3 Pacific Standard Time LALA shows taking place in the desert. And this Saturday, architect Barbara Bester, designer of the exhibition Albert Frey and Lena Bobardi, will talk about that show with its curators. See details about this and other events relating to the exhibitions on our blog. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. And thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next. Now we have a quick favor to ask you, our podcast listeners. KCRW wants to learn more about you, who you are and how you listen. So if you have 3 minutes in which you could help us out, go to kcrw.com/survey. Thank you very much.